This is the Voice of Freedom.
In the balance.
Revolution
is always in some ways contradict some laws. That's why it's called revolution.
We are not engaged in a struggle that means we sit down and do nothing. You do resist in a very strong and determined manner. This approach certainly doesn't make the white man feel comfortable.
As long as the Negro finds himself living every day in a major depression, every city will sit on a powder keg and can explode over the slightest incident.
You can't run liberation out the country. You can't murder freedom, DJ.
What do you see as the meaning of the term revolutionary?
We understand that there are only a few people who own and control the means of production in the society, then we begin to understand that there are a few capitalists. And these capitalists exploit everybody because everybody works for them. Everybody sells their labor to them. The sole motivating force in a capitalist society is profit. Get money. Get it. Hell, your country is napalming for money.
The people are going to have to attack the pigs. The people are going to have to stand up against the pigs.
Liberty is nothing more than a prison of poverty.
You are producing extremists by the thousands.
Black power to black people. Brown power to brown
people. Our culture has been in conflict with the American capitalist culture and continues to be and will be
until we destroy
it. Before you go to bed, night time, I'm a revolutionary. Make that the last word.
You can't do it unless you believe that you can do it.
Do you believe?
I know I do.
Everything would be all right if everything was put back in the hands of the
What is the haps, Hep Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? It's the Higgity Higgity host with the most, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See, here on another Friday morning in America. Back from a bit of a siesta, a bit's happened, had to replace some recording equipment, replace the laptop situation, fix some issues with some recording equipment, and also still dealing with the general, what the fuck is going on that I have about everything involved with the United States of America right now. Before I get into rambling about bullshit, I do want to send a special shout out and thank you to a listener of the show, Salem, for backing up all of the episodes of the show for me whenever there was a question as to whether or not my hard drive was going to crash and I was going to lose hundreds of hours of materials. So I want to thank Salem for spending literal fucking hours ripping audio from one of the platforms that carries the show and going so far as to mail me the ripped audio files of the show so that I have them in case anything happens to the thing where they exist. You know, that's a weird thing. I've been vibing on this a lot in the second half of this season that seems to go on forever. as a person who works in a digital medium, it's really, really odd to think sometimes that I've spent, at this point, literally thousands of hours working on this show and my previous show, and all of that actual finished product, right? Not the notes, because I have a fucking metric ton of notebooks full of outlines and scripts and things of that nature, but the finished product, the actual show, come and see, doesn't exist in the physical world anywhere, right? That it's a digital thing that you listen to on a digital thing carried by a digital thing provider, right? It doesn't exist in the physical world. So if anything were to happen to Spotify, God forbid, because they're such a fantastic company, they've paved me so goddamn much for this. If anything were to happen to Spotify or you know, again, my computer, all of the show would just cease to exist. And that's hard to think about sometimes. So having a physical representation of my work is kind of a mind fuck in a way, because until now I didn't really have one. You know, I've talked a lot about in the Bill Cooper tradition, translating all of the shows to cassette tape, perhaps compact disc, and maybe selling them in the merch store as kind of a thing, you know, in case you're one of those hipster people who likes to just feel the weight of it in your hands, whatever. But it's strange to think of myself as a person who has this ever-growing body of work that doesn't actually exist as a body of work anywhere but the internet, and that's kind of fucking crazy. That's neither here nor there, though. It has absolutely nothing to do with anything else that we're going to be talking about today. Something else that has nothing to do with anything else we're going to be talking about today. I don't know if you saw that Ted Kaczynski and Pat Robertson died. Weird week it's been. You know, I don't really have anything good to say about either one of them for the most part. I think Ted was right about a lot. He was wrong about more than he was right about. But, you know, he wasn't entirely wrong about technology neutering the human race, I think. And again, I say this as a person whose entire career exists digitally. So it's a strange thing to conceptualize that, you know, technology's probably fucking us up in more ways than it's actually helping us, but I should also definitely use this impermanent system as a way to, you know, make my livelihood. Why not? My understanding is Ted had cancer and may or may not have committed suicide. Pat, I think, died from just being 93 and evil for too long. We're going to do an episode about Pat here in the near future. I haven't decided if I want to talk about Ted Kaczynski or not, because it's dry, it's boring, there's a lot of things to parse with the fact that he was essentially a liberal who held many left ideals, who was highly critical of the left and social liberalism, like, you know, every leftist ever. So it's complicated, because Ted really represents in a lot of ways how the further out there you go, the closer you get to the other end of the spectrum, because as was noted by Tim McVeigh, Ted and I actually have a lot more in common than you would have expected. I didn't think we'd get along at all, but he's not that bad of a guy. It's not a good thing that you think that, Tim. So that's a thing that happened. People who support Ron DeSantis brought Nazi flags to Disney World. That's a thing that happened. And it's also just a weird, you know, the passage of time reveals all things kind of a thing, that we went from the guy who started the company being a virulent anti-Semite to the company is now at war with neo-Nazis because of its support for the queer community. Or is it because of book bannings? You know, I don't even know what the fuck they're angry about at this point. I just know that a lot of people who I hate Disney, who I also hate, but I hate the people who hate Disney more than I hate Disney. So it's really a mind fuck to try to put into perspective that someone has decided to go after the Disney Corporation, and they're so fucking dog shit, I'm actually rooting for the Disney Corporation. I don't understand how that's possible, but if there's one constant truth in the universe, it is that American politicians will find a way to outdo themselves on a race to the bottom of the barrel. So that's going on. Also, Trump got indicted twice, apparently. I did not see that coming. And while Trump is indicted and these things are going on, Ron DeSantis is potentially being investigated for kidnapping because he spent, what was it, $70 million or something like that. No, it couldn't have been that much, but it was a lot of fucking money having a bunch of immigrants flown to California under the auspices that they were going to be given houses and jobs, and then they were just dumped at an archdiocese. Because I guess as the governor of Florida, who's trying to tank the fucking economy of an entire state, it's also dope to play frat house pranks on people who are refugees from other countries who are fleeing situations that your government created. So it's a weird old time in the American news, but you know what the fuck else is new? It's also Pride, and as such, you know, last year I was on break, I think, in June, in between seasons 2 and 3. I think that was kind of my down period, actually. So we didn't cover a whole lot of like queer struggle, queer rights, queer awareness, Pride-related things on the show last year, and that feels like a detriment to me, so I kind of wanted to, you know, run that back and do some things related to those subjects and issues for Pride this year. And because I'm not just going to talk about, like, where the rainbow flag came from, that's not really what I do, I figured to kick off queer awareness and pride things on the show, we might have a conversation about Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church. Because I hate myself and I wanted to spend several days reading about Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church, I really should see a therapist. And, you know, to that point, Fred Phelps is a complicated fucking person, and it was very, very difficult for me personally, as a black, you know, a black person who ascribes to liberation theory, for example, to contextualize this cat who, you know, let me back up, actually. My first introductions to the Westboro Baptist Church, like a lot of you probably, was the group that protested the Matthew Shepard funeral, and we are going to talk about that later on, but they were also because my introduction to street activism, protesting, and direct action was gay marriage protest, gay rights protest, marriage equality, those kinds of things. The Westboro Baptist Church was counter-protesting some of the first rallies I ever attended as a young person. So they've always kind of been around. And it's interesting to contextualize now, you know, 20 years on from that, that these were just kind of like circus clowns with dumb fuck signs trying to get attention. But at the time, there was this real feeling that they represented the religious right's feelings about queer people. And, you know, they do and they don't. I think that one thing that's fascinating about Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church is that they are so universally disliked, they bring disparate groups of people together. You can get a Hell's Angel, a communist, a drag queen, and I don't know, Mitt Romney in a room together and bring up Westboro and no one has anything positive to say. And that's something you can't say about a whole lot of groups and or people. And a big part of what was so complicated about doing research on Fred is he is a man of many contradictions. You know, The point I was making with the fact that he's been part of my life as an activist for as long as I've been an activist is I have known and grown to hate Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church, unlike many other political entities. So learning that the guy was prolific in the civil rights movement and did a lot of other things that had me scratching my head were difficult to understand, difficult to put in context. You know, this is a guy who hated a lot of the same things that I hate, but I think it was more of a broken clock thing, and Fred kind of hated everybody, including his own family, and we'll get into that a bit as well. And there's also something to be said for, and this is actually, I'm going to tell you that I'm doing this so that you're aware of it when it happens in a few weeks. There's an element of, like, pimp psychology to the way Fred treated his family. You know, I'm going to do an episode that sort of discusses the history of facilitation and contrasts it with a term that my good friend Professor Nico Iguana introduced me to, high control groups, and how that, as a tradition that's been around for like over 2,000 years, has kind of informed politics, religious leaders, cults, all kinds of different groups, and how violent conditioning and worker exploitation kind of go hand in hand as pimp shit, and how a lot of these guys, you know, Fred Phelps, Charles Manson, I think, is another one, and that was what really cued me onto it in the first place, and that Fred's daughter, Shirley, is a lot like the Manson girls in very many ways. Opposite ends of the ideological spectrum, very, very, very similar people, and I think it comes down to they had a weird and unnatural form of discipline beaten into them by a very angry man at some point. So there's that as well. And there's also Fred's own religious beliefs, which are very, very complicated when put in application. So we're going to talk about something called the Tulip Doctrine today, which is part of Calvinism, which means that I'm going to be going back into high school and college period theology for me, which is always great because everybody who's been listening to the show for a while knows I loved high school. The religious fundamentalism thing is a slippery bit, you know what I mean? And probably more so with Fred than anybody, because he doesn't really squarely fit into the bubble of religious fundamentalists. The man hated other Christians. He hated the Catholic Church, he hated televangelism, he hated missionaries, he hated every other denomination of Christianity. I think that the only thing you can say that made sense about Fred is if he knew you, he didn't like you. And it's interesting to see how that has trickled down over, what would we be at now, four or five generations of the Phelps family in that church, and how we've gone from Fred, the patriarch, to now where most of the young people have left the church and some of them are openly queer. Many of them are queer activists. So that's hopeful in a way that shows that over a long enough timeline, people may stop being naturally dumbfuck. But we're not going to talk about them today. We're going to talk about Fred Phelps, the Westboro Baptist Church, and God hates fags. Which, I should probably mention up top, you're going to hear that word a lot today, so if that upsets you, this probably isn't an episode for you. But being that the veritable slogan of the group that we're talking about today, it was, and is, they're still active, God hates fags, I'm not going to be censoring that word every 10 minutes whenever I need to use it. I just want to give you a trigger warning that there will be homophobic slurs throughout today's show. So, I don't know what to say other than that. This is, it's going to be fairly light, all things considered, but there's a lot fucking going on. This guy was a wet bag of cats in human skin. So, having said that, let's get the fuck into it. Here we go.
God is now America's terrorist. God duped you into starting a war so he could punish you. And any preacher preaching it any other way is a lying, hell-bound, false prophet. It's almost 18 months now, and the siege has got people eating their babies and their small children and each other. You're gonna eat your babies!
Fred Waldron Phelps was born in Meridian, Mississippi in 1929. His mother died of cancer when he was 6 years old, and he was raised by his Aunt Irene until his father remarried in 1944. Fred's father, also Fred Wade, to be specific, was a devout Methodist. I actually expected to find deeply religious parents who influenced Fred's extreme religious views, but that's not really the case. His father was a railroad policeman who wanted his son to join the military. He fought to get Fred accepted into West Point after his graduation, and Fred had graduated sixth in his class, so he did have a good standing, and the family itself had a fairly pristine reputation socially in Meridian, where they were from. But Fred didn't want to go to military school. This may be the impetus for everything that came later, but before he was supposed to attend West Point, Fred Phelps went to a tent revival. And it's at that tent revival that Fred decided he wanted to go into, I don't know a better way to say it other than ministry. You can't say he wanted to go into hate mongering, can you? Probably not. But he came to the conclusion that he was being led by God into ministry. His experience at the tent revival at East End Methodist Church in Meridian was so transformative that in an interview that he gave in 1994, when he was running for governor, we'll get to it, Fred said that he could even recount what parable the sermon at the revival was about. Quote, "It was the parable where the Lord Jesus said a certain man made a great supper and bade many to come, and they all began to make excuses. He said the kingdom of heaven is like unto man who made a great supper. His application of it was there is no logical, rational reason why any human being should not get right with God in his heart. I remember that sermon pretty doggone good." End quote. And, you know, we're going to talk more about Fred's personal religious beliefs in a bit, but to sort of turn the page a little bit early, it's very strange trying to understand how Fred came to the conclusion that he needed to be a missionary, particularly a missionary who spent the exorbitant amounts of money that he did traveling to tell people the things that he was telling them, because Fred Phelps believed in predestination. Meaning that Fred Phelps didn't believe in choices. You know, I had a very interesting conversation with a friend of mine trying to understand the way this man's mind worked and how he was able to work for civil rights, for example. Again, we'll get to it, but hate the queer community as fervently as he did, and not just queer people, Jews, Muslims, fucking everybody, but was recognized with distinguishment for outstanding work in the Black community. And how is that possible? And my friend suggested perhaps it's in that homosexuality is a choice. And perhaps that's the case. But Fred didn't believe in choice. So why spend $250,000 a year doing missionary work if you think God has already decided who's going to heaven and who isn't? Honestly means that nothing anyone does matters. And that includes gay sex, Fred. That if God has already chosen the elect, and good on you if your entire family managed to be members out of the trillions of people who've probably been alive throughout the entirety of human history, that, you know, the 14 of you managed to make it onto that list of 1,400 people. That's fucking impressive. Well done to you. Those kids must be good at something. But to believe that God has selected a set number of people who are going to heaven, and that it would matter whether you tell people what they're doing is wrong when they're gonna go to heaven or hell regardless, seems counterintuitive, or I don't know, illogical to me. And this was one of the first big roadblocks that I had to understanding this man, because he was simultaneously driven by his own fervent Calvinism, and part and parcel of that is the belief that God has predetermined everything, but also people need to repent and get right with God. And I say to you, perhaps as a non-Christian who grew up as a religious person, if you're gonna go to heaven or hell no matter what, who the fuck cares what God thinks? I just, you know, there's not much sense in repenting if you're going to heaven anyway. And I would think that if God's decided where you're going when you die before you're born, go ahead and fuck whoever you want. It doesn't actually make a difference. You know, and to be fair, I don't have a degree in bullshit from Bob Jones University, so maybe there's a part of it I'm missing in the conversation. It is super fucking difficult not to get ahead of myself on this one, because we've got a lot to get into, but friends and relatives of the Phelps family report that after attending this tent revival, Fred really lost touch with reality, that his personality changed. People who knew him as a child have said that he was a quiet, reserved, and polite kid, and that they can make neither hide nor hair of the man they later saw on television and in newspapers screaming vitriolic bigotry as a message from God. And this new religious fervor left no room for West Point, as Fred believed that God was calling him to missionary work. In 1947, Fred enrolled in Bob Jones University. We've talked a little bit about Bob Jones University in the past, mostly about their refusal to integrate until they were threatened with the loss of tax exemption in the 70s. The university was founded as Bob Jones College in 1927 by Bob Jones Sr., who was an evangelist, a segregationist, a vocal ally of the Ku Klux Klan, a prohibitionist, and obviously a racist from rural Alabama. Jones was a follower of what's called primitive baptism, which is a form of Calvinism that Phelps himself would adopt while attending Bob Jones University. Primitive, or hard shell, Baptists first really appeared in the 19th century, like all of the other worst things. Primitive baptism rose out of a dispute amongst sets of Baptists over their participation in organizations outside of the church, like temperance societies, Bible tract societies, and mission boards. Primitive Baptists reject outside institutions, and this is explained in the Cahokia Association Declaration of 1827, which was issued by the Cahokia Primitive Baptist Church. Quote, upon examination, it was found that most of the churches had given their opinions, and after an interchange of sentiments among the members of this body, it was agreed that we discard all missionary societies, Bible societies, and theological seminaries, and the practices heretofore resorted to for their support in begging money from the public, and if any persons should be among us, As agents of any of said societies, we hereafter discountenance them in those practices. And if under a character of a minister of the gospel, we will not invite them into our pulpits, believing these societies and institutions to be the inventions of men, and not warranted from the word of God. We further do unanimously agree that should any of the members of our churches join the fraternity of Masons, or being members continue to visit the lodges and parades, we will not invite them to preach in our pulpits, believing them to be guilty of such practices, and we declare non-fellowship with them and such practices altogether. Now, this is very interesting in how it shapes the way Fred runs his church later, because what we're going to discuss when we start talking about what Fred did as far as being a lawyer, the entire time that he was running this church from the late 1960s until 2013, he never accepted a donation from anyone. He accepted no outside assistance, no financial support from anybody. All of the money used to fund the Westboro Baptist Church was made by suing people. And we'll get into that a bit here shortly, but I have to believe that this no outsiders, we do everything inside our own house mentality to how Fred maintained his church, adjacent to the pimp shit, which we're going to get into, is evident in this form of Calvinistic baptism that said you don't take support from anyone outside of the church. And the Westboro Baptist Church went so far as to practically not recognize other denominations of Christianity. So we see here in his introduction to radical, extreme, almost zealotous fundamentalist Christianity, the beginnings of who Fred Phelps would end up being. And it didn't take long for him to get there. The leap from, I think I want to go to military school, to God talked to me in a tent, and now he needs me to tell everyone how much he hates them, was very, very short. And, you know, if I can divert for a few seconds, I've always felt like Fred, and this is even more ironic considering he worked for Billy Graham for a time, right, is sort of an example of how so many people who have this idea of scriptural inerrancy, that's this idea, the belief that the Bible can't be wrong because it's spoken directly by God, right? That so many Christians have this idea based on scriptural inerrancy in many cases, that the Bible and God are telling them two diametrically opposed things. They both cite the same reading material, but some will tell you that unconditional love and forgiveness and charity is the message, and others will tell you that, you know, God hates fags, it was the message. Or, still more people might believe that God wants you to handle cobras, as we've discussed in the past. So it's almost like that. I'm sure many of you heard the analogy in school of several people witnessing a car accident, but they all give very, very different reports of what they saw based on perspective. In so much as people filter everything through what they want to hear, I think, at the end of the day, the various interpretations of the absolute truth of the Bible and how much so many of them have, you know, nothing the fuck to do with one another is endlessly fascinating to me. But I'll go on. This split in the Baptists constituted old and new schools of Baptist thinking, and as you would expect, Fred was old school. Primitive baptism leans heavily into the five points of Calvinism. This is commonly abbreviated by the acronym TULIP. The TULIP doctrine is also called the Doctrine of Grace. It's summarized thusly. Total depravity, which is to say that humanity possesses free will, but it is inherently sinful. Now, I spent the better part of a week arguing with a pastor slash quote-unquote Bible teacher about the Tulip Doctrine in high school, because to me, it's inherently contradictory. Also sort of negates the need for anyone to, if this is your ethical basis, why anyone would ever do the right thing ever. If everything is predetermined and ultimately it doesn't matter because your fate is chosen before you were born, nothing you do makes a difference. And I don't know, there's something in me that feels like there is a connecting point between, you know, Barron's concept of the banality of evil and the belief that some really, really terrible people have leaned on this as a form of acceptance to justify that God still chose them to be successful and powerful, even though they're moralless and terrifying people. But there's this interesting thing to me in believing that all of your choices were made before you, so there's not really any stakes in anything. And it permits you to live in, I think, sort of a realm of moral relativism, because there aren't really going to be consequences for your actions if you believe your reward is preordained. You dig what I'm saying? It's okay for you to do bad things because you were going to go to heaven anyway. And, you know, if we could pull that back even further, the same teacher and I had another of many, many, many protracted debates about the idea that only Christians truly understand moral behavior. But I would argue that if your entire moral and belief system are based on the idea that you get something for doing them, is that altruism? If you're well aware that being a good person means you get what in your mind is the best thing that could ever happen to anyone as a reward for moral behavior, are you doing the right thing because it's the right thing, or are you doing the right thing because the angel Gabriel will give you a rim job after you die of a heart attack at 55 because you've been mainlining Chick-fil-A for 20 years? Maybe that was a bit too specific. But you see what I'm saying. I think that there's a questionable basis to the idea that you've done the right thing and you're a moral person if you are well aware that you're getting something for being a good person. I think that Jesus himself in the book, in the red print, may have said something about tithing loudly or praying loudly and praying quietly, in fact, those of you who are into that sort of thing. Yes, I've read the book. I'll go on. In addition to total depravity is the belief in unconditional election. And this is what I was talking about earlier that refers to predestination. It describes the actions and motives of God prior to his creation of the world, wherein he predestined some people, called the elect, for salvation and the rest for damnation and eternal punishment. God's elections are supposed to be beyond human comprehension and unrelated to the qualities related to the persons he chose. In other words, nothing you do gets you into heaven. Being a good person is sort of irrelevant. And there's also sort of a, okay, we're not supposed to be able to understand how gods think, even though we invented them, so they think like us. But if I may, if all of your choices were made by God for you before you made them, isn't punishing you for them arbitrary? Because in all reality, you didn't make those choices. They were predestined for you to make. So why would someone who's supposed to be omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent, and therefore, I don't know, not fucking stupid, punish you for something they quite literally made you do? It's almost like God thinks like a man, perhaps a morally dubious and yet highly performatively moral man, perhaps a European man, even perhaps one named Calvin. But it's very indicative of, and you know, we're gonna divert even further, because if I gotta talk about homophobes for a fucking hour and a half, I'm gonna go off. You know, we talked about this, I think, on some of the episodes where we discuss extraterrestrials, in that something that you see over and over and over again is that the representations of creatures from other worlds mirror things we understand about ourselves. And in much the same way, and this does in fact relate, because if ultra-dimensional beings are supposed to be representations of all of those things, extraterrestrials, aliens, angels, God, all of that stuff, God, in much the same way, mirrors humans' understanding of human nature and human interpersonal relationships and human activity. Why a deity who's in control of the width and breadth of the universe cares who you fuck or when you jack off is beyond me. And maybe that's the point. It's supposed to be beyond me, but I it seems like a very anthropomorphic way to view an all-powerful being within the scope of limitations of sometimes God makes you horny and then punishes you for being horny because it bees like that sometimes. And you know what? Sticking with the theme of predestination, I've been off work for close to a month, so I have a lot of thoughts. I'm actually going to, spoiler alert, like the next 8 or 9 minutes of what I'm going to talk about, because it relates to the new Spider-Man movie, and a lot of you probably haven't seen that, but it's an interesting allegory for what we're talking about with the idea of predestination, right? So, spoiler alert. Okay, so if you've seen the film, a lot of the plot structure has to do with the idea that Spider-Man, the character, has a set canon that has to be followed, or else the entire reality in which Spider-Man exists ceases to be, right? That everything, that there are set moments in the life of Spider-Man, Peter Parker, whatever, that have to happen for him to be Spider-Man. Now, I have sort of a problem with this conceptually, because I think that something you see in comic books rather frequently is this idea that in order to be a hero or a good person or do the right thing, something terrible has to happen to you first. It's that you activate your empathy through tragedy, that you don't just have the ability to be a good or empathetic person. You have to experience heart-wrenching loss in order to be a human being. And I think that that's a dangerous message to send people, first and foremost. But I also think that Miles Morales as Spider-Man is unique in that context, because he doesn't become Spider-Man born out of tragedy. He's just a good kid. And I think that there's something to be said for this idea that you can just do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, and not because, you know, you're gonna go to heaven when you die, or a book told you to, or someone's going to give you money for it, or it might benefit your reputation. I think that there is, in fact, a possibility to engage altruism, charitable behavior, being a good Samaritan, whatever the fuck you want to call it, without it being tied to a net benefit to the self in some way. And I think that's also part of why I have such a problem with this Christian idea that morals and your faith are intertwined, because how moral is your behavior if you get something for it? I don't know that's I'm getting away from the thread of predestination, and I understand that. The point that I was making is that I think that there's a danger in saying that you need to be following a set path for things that comes from this idea of predetermination, of canon, of inevitability. I think that that's a dangerously self-serving way to live your life. This idea that things are bound to happen, things are predetermined to happen, or that like some guy you don't know who lives in outer space wrote down everything you were gonna do before you were born. I know, that's a gross oversimplification of the God thing. I was more making a joke than anything. Don't get angry. But I think that when we start talking about the idea of predestination and predetermination, it really, to me, as a non-faith person, it becomes this conversation of what's the point of any of that then? Why did a being, presumably of male distinction, if the books are all to be believed, because why anyone who isn't a man would do any of this shit is beyond me, sort of conceives of an experiment, because I guess that's what's going on here, and decided how everything was going to go and exactly how everything was going to end forever, but still ran the experiment. Ironically, God sounds like a really bad scientist, considering how frequently religion and science are at odds. But anyway, that's probably neither here nor there. It's just an interesting bit to me whenever I start thinking about predestination. And this also probably ties into why I fucking hate the concept of time travel so much, because in a way, time travel suggests a degree of predetermination, no? Because if you can go into the future and things are just as they are, doesn't that just suggest that there's a way things are going to go? And that really suggesting in a way that there's a way to alter time suggests that time has a set path and therefore we are in fact on an immutable pathway to a destination, and things aren't just happening, they're supposed to happen or not supposed to happen. And it's one of those ways that like science and religion have a lot of, science fiction in particular, and like religion have a whole lot in common whenever you start dripping them down to brass tacks. Anyway, I was talking about the Protestant, or I'm sorry, the Calvinistic tulip doctrine, and I got way off topic. So I'm going to rein myself back in here. The next on the list of aspects of TULIP is justification through faith, which is also known as sola fide. It's a foundational aspect of Protestantism, really. Justification through faith asserts that faith rather than works, or what we do, determines salvation. There are various denominational interpretations of justification through faith, but at a baseline, it holds that nothing we do earns salvation. Then there's irresistible grace, or monergism. Monergism is the theological belief that the Holy Spirit works within the individual towards salvation through something called spiritual regeneration, with or without the individual's consent. In other words, you don't choose to seek salvation. God chooses to make you want it or not. And your faith grows after God has already elected to give it to you. Now, you might argue that that's not so much faith as coercion, and I just agree with you. Now, Calvin does assure us that the process is not violent, but then he's also known as the least anti-Semitic of the Protestant reformers, so take that for what it's worth. Next, we have limited atonement, or a particular redemption, which asserts that Jesus's substitutionary atonement, dying on the cross for everybody's sins and whatnot, was definite and certain in its purpose and in what it accomplished. That implies that only the sins of those elected by God were atoned for by Jesus's death. But Calvinists don't believe that the atonement is limited in its power, but that the atonement is limited in the sense that it is intended for only some people. A quote would be, the atonement is sufficient for all and efficient for the elect. You may or may not be noticing a ha ha ha, I'm better than you pattern with all of this shit. And finally, is the perseverance or preservation of the saints. This asserts that once a person is regenerated by the Holy Spirit, they become a good person who does good things. And this is all part of that concept of election, and you'll note again, choice has very little to do with any of it. The Tulip Doctrine itself dates back to the 17th century, but it rose to prominence in America in 1963 after the release of David N. Steele's The Five Points of Calvinism, Defined, Defended, Documented. And Fred was, this is still about Fred Phelps, as best as I can tell, exposed to these ideas by Bob Jones during his time at Bob Jones University. So, in that way, a heightened religious emotional experience at the tent revival, something that's not an uncommon experience, especially for younger people who are more susceptible to groupthink mentality, and the radicalization and tutelage of notorious bigot Bob Jones, shaped the Reverend Fred Phelps. His new religious disposition disappointed and confused his father and the rest of his family, and Fred stopped speaking to his family entirely before dropping out of college. He would never reestablish communication, nor would he allow members of his family to do so. In a sense, the first person excommunicated from Fred's church was his dad. But before Fred built that church, he built something of a reputation for himself. As I mentioned, he dropped out of Bob Jones University in 1948 and moved to California to become a street preacher. He also enrolled in John Muir College in Pasadena. Phelps's striking rhetoric about promiscuity, pedophilia, profanity, and homosexuality got him featured in an issue of Time magazine in June of 1951. Shortly thereafter, the college ordered Phelps to stop proselytizing on school property, so he moved across the street. In other words, this behavior manifested really fucking early. Phelps met Margie Sims in October of 1951. He then married her in May of 1952. They had their first child within a year and were working on their second when they moved to Topeka, Kansas in 1954. Fred was hired by the East Side Baptist Church as an associate pastor. The following year, Eastside Baptist acquired Westboro Baptist Church across town, and Fred was made the pastor. He preached his primitive Baptist doctrine along with a specific and vitriolic hatred of homosexuals, the Jews, and anything secular, as well as an eschatological, apocalyptic, almost charismatic style of Christianity that soon alienated everyone but Fred's ever-growing family and his ever-dwindling inner circle. Before long, they were all that was left at Westboro, and with limited congregation size, Fred sold vacuum cleaners door to door and forced his children to work full time selling candy door to door until he was investigated for child labor violations. In 1964, Fred earned a law degree from Washburn University and founded the Phelps Chartered Law Firm. In 1973, Phelps received national attention from the lawsuit Johnson v. Topeka Board of Education, where he represented a 10-year-old black child named Evelyn Renee Johnson in suing the Topeka Board of Education, as well as related local, state, and federal officials. Phelps argued that Topeka had failed to fall in line with the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education ruling, and that the predominantly black schools on Topeka's east side provided an inferior education. He initially attempted to file a class action lawsuit and sought integrated busing plus $200 million in damages, or $20,000 per each of Topeka's 10,000 black students currently attending the East Side. The court denied this and limited the filing to Johnson, Phelps' initial plaintiff. As a result of the case, the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare ordered the Topeka Board of Education to make substantive changes. The board later settled the case, and Phelps made $12,400 in the endeavor. Phelps' early legal career saw him representing black workers in employment discrimination suits. He sued Kansas City Power and Light for discrimination. In 1986, he sued Ronald Reagan for violating the separation of church and state after Reagan appointed a U.S. ambassador to the Vatican. The NAACP's Greater Kansas City chapter gave Phelps multiple awards in the 1980s for outstanding work on behalf of the black community. And I want to stress again what I said up top, that this did not happen separate from Fred's constant homophobic street preaching. There are records that he was asked by the university to stop preaching on campus, on school property, just like he was at John Muir. Phelps was disbarred in 1985 based on allegations that dated back to 1977. The complaint was filed by the Kansas State Board of Law Examiners due to Phelps' conduct during a lawsuit against a court reporter named Caroline Brady. Brady had not had a transcript ready for Phelps on the day that he asked for it, so he sued her for $22,000. The trial had shades of Heinrich Kramer, the author of the Malleus Maleficarum, who we discussed back in season 3, in that Phelps attacked Brady's reputation for nearly a week, attempting to subpoena Brady's ex-boyfriends. At one point, he called her a slut on the stand. He accused her of various sexual perversions until at one point she broke down into tears. According to the Kansas Supreme Court, quote, "The trial became an exhibition of a personal vendetta by Phelps against Caroline Brady. His examination was replete with repetition, badgering, innuendo, belligerence, irrelevant and immaterial matters, evidencing only a desire to hurt and destroy the defendant. The jury verdict didn't stop the onslaught of Phelps. He was not satisfied with the hurt, pain, and damage he had visited on Caroline Brady." End quote. In an appeal to the decision, Phelps prepared affidavits swearing to the court that he had 8 witnesses whose testimonies could sway the court in his favor. Caroline Brady obtained sworn and signed affidavits from all 8 of these people saying they had never spoken with Fred Phelps and had no reason to testify against Caroline Brady. As a result, Phelps was found to have made false statements, and on July 20th, 1979, Fred Phelps was permanently disbarred from practicing law in Kansas. He continued to practice federally until 1989, when continuous complaints from judges forced Fred to agree to stop practicing law altogether. Phelps Chartered remains active, however, as most of the Phelps family are employed there. And that's a big goddamn family, by the way. 13 children, 54 grandchildren, and 7 great-grandchildren. And the family is highly litigious and funds itself almost exclusively through lawsuits, having sued Topeka's city government and the state of Kansas literally hundreds of times for tens of thousands of dollars. The Phelps family and the Westboro Baptist Church remained relatively unknown on a national level from their inception in the 1950s until 1998, when their protest at the funeral of 21-year-old gay student Matthew Shepard made news across the country. I'm going to trigger warning the next several minutes of the show because it's graphic and a bit difficult to listen to if you're upset by, well, hate crimes. So, trigger warning. Matthew Shepard was murdered on August 6th, 1998 by Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson, who had offered him a ride home before beating, robbing, and torturing him, and then leaving him tied to a barbed wire fence in below zero temperatures. The men were later arrested the same evening for assault against 2 other people, 19-year-old Emiliano Morales and 18-year-old Jeremy Herrera. I'm not going to call attention to the fact that the other 2 people these guys assaulted both sound like they probably weren't white. You probably could infer that on your own. Anyway, after being arrested, the men were found in possession of Shepard's shoes and his credit card, as well as a gun that was smeared with blood because it had been used to cave Shepard's skull in. Matthew Shepard was found in a coma 18 hours later, still tied to the barbed wire fence. He remained brain dead on life support for 6 days before being pronounced dead on October 12th. The Matthew Shepard incident drew national attention and criticism of the way we view hate crimes and hate crime legislation. Something that, well, fortunately, we'd finally address nearly 20 fucking years later. The murder was first attributed to drugs and reported as having nothing to do with Shepard's homosexuality until it was revealed that all involved parties were dead clean fucking sober and Henderson's girlfriend gave sworn testimony that his actions were motivated by his homophobia. The Westboro Baptist Church protested Shepard's funeral, exposing many of us to their slogan, "God hates fags," for the first time. The church appeared outside the courthouse during Henderson and McKinney's trial, celebrating their actions and generating quite a lot of buzz for their unique brand of mask-off hate speech. This also led to the church being featured as characters in the 2000 Laramie Project, a theater piece about Shepard's death. The church picketed that too. A lot of people who aren't old enough to remember the Matthew Shepard murder probably have difficulty, especially if you're young enough that you were born perhaps after the gay marriage legalization thing. Don't remember that the sort of fear and realization that came along for a lot of people, especially people in the queer community, with the Matthew Shepard murder, and also the realization that, you know, if you're any kind of a marginalized person, I think you can relate to that. The general public will pretend, but they don't really give a fuck what happens to you. And I think that, in a way, Westboro kind of disallowed the average person from having that opinion, because I think something interesting happens whenever you have to look at the extreme interpretation of what you represent. As a person who says things of this nature, well, if you don't want those kinds of things to happen, you shouldn't put yourself in those sorts of situations. It's really, really hard to hold that perspective when you're looking at an angry 70-year-old man screaming about how a gay kid is in hell because he's a faggot. So I think that in many ways, unintentionally, Westboro pushed that conversation in a very specific direction, because there's a lot of people who I think are and were homophobic who didn't really give a shit about what happened to Matthew Shepard, but really, really didn't want to be identified with Westboro. So this conversation nationally about hate crimes and hate speech was kind of further highlighted by this weirdo fucking church from rural Kansas who said that they hated queer people because God told them to. Now, we could, you know, go back into what we were talking about a few minutes ago and how it's strange to hold that belief as a Calvinist who thinks that God chooses to make some people sin and chooses to make some people not, which would almost suggest that you're gay because God wants you to be, and isn't that an interesting way to contextualize things? But nonetheless, the Westboro Baptist Church became, in the wake of the Matthew Shepard murder and the Laramie Project, sort of a nationally recognized, what word do I want to use? Sect? Group, conglomeration of shitbags, I don't really know, but suddenly they were being reported on internationally, and I think, if I may, this represents another turning point for Fred and the Church, I believe. If we want to look at the introduction of Bob Jones Sr.'s rhetoric as something that shaped Fred, I think national attention shaped Fred even more. And I believe that while he wouldn't take money from anybody, he loved the attention he was getting. At one point in an interview that Fred gave, he said that all of the negative reaction to what he was doing was proof to him that he was correct. This is a guy with obstinate defiance disorder, if I've ever fucking seen one. So I think that not only in the negative reinforcement of these are terrible people and we should all dislike them that Fred viewed as getting a pat on the head, the shift from just focusing on homosexuals in the national arena to what they would go on to do later in protesting the funerals of dead soldiers, I think Fred really became motivated by needing that negative attention. That even though it didn't translate to donations, I think that the attention really got this guy off. And I wonder how he felt about that, because he strikes me as someone who would think that ejaculation is a sin that should be punishable by self-flagellation. I don't know, maybe he owned a Solis. Anyway, in 2001, Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church appeared in a film called Union in Wait, which aired at the Sundance Film Festival. And in 2005, they were the subject of an investigative documentary on the BBC. The documentary, which was an unflattering hidden camera piece that showed Phelps' grandchildren discussing their joy at the idea that everyone would go to hell but them and their family, and that even if they didn't believe God wanted them to hate everyone, they would anyway because they enjoyed it. Proving, once and for all, the old adage that the family that prays together stays together, or whatever, they basically excommunicated half of the family, and the half that wasn't excommunicated left on their own. But we'll get into that. In 2005, Phelps and his church signed a petition to repeal two city ordinances that added sexual orientation to a definition of hate crimes and banned the city of Topeka from workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation. During this rise in media prominence, Fred, like most men of his ilk, tried his hand at politics. A lifelong registered Democrat, Phelps campaigned on behalf of Al Gore back when Al still openly hated gay people. Fred disavowed Gore when he changed his stance on gay marriage. Phelps himself ran for governor as a Democrat in 1990, 1994, and 1998. In that year, he received 15% of the vote, actually. He ran for senator in 1992, again as a Democrat, and received 31% of the vote. He also ran for mayor of Topeka in 1993 and again in 1997. Though vocally Islamophobic, Phelps was highly critical of the Iraq War and also an open supporter of Saddam Hussein for his acceptance of Christian missionaries in Iraq. After 9/11, the Westboro Baptist Church upped its political presence by declaring the attack on the World Trade Center was God's judgment for America's sinful nature and acceptance of homosexuality. The church picketed its first military funeral in July of 2005, protesting the memorial service of Kerry French, who was killed in Iraq. The following year, Westboro debuted the slogans God Hates America and Thank God for Dead Soldiers at the funeral of U.S. Marine Matthew Snyder. Matthew Snyder's father sued Phelps, as well as his daughters Shirley Phelps Roper and Rebecca Phelps Davis, and three other members of the congregation for intentionally inflicting emotional distress. The Maryland District Court ruled in Snyder's favor, handing down a judgment of $10.9 million in damages. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the decision, holding that the Westboro Church's signs were rhetorical hyperbole and figurative expression, and thus protected by the First Amendment. Snyder appealed to the Supreme Court, who ruled 8-1 in favor of Fred Phelps. The only dissenting opinion came from Justice Alito, not from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who noted in 2011 that Alito's dissent was heartfelt, and while nobody in the court agreed, she knew a lot of the public following the trial did. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is undeserving of your admiration and we should abolish the Supreme Court. Anyway, Snyder, who was a gay man himself, died of lung complications 10 weeks after the ruling. The Westboro Church continued to protest military funerals throughout the early 2000s until the passage of the Respect for America's Fallen Heroes Act, a congressional act that prohibits protests within 300 feet of the entrance of any cemetery under the control of the National Cemetery Administration, a division of the Department of Veteran Affairs, from 1 hour before to 1 hour after a funeral, with a fine of $100,000 and up to 1 year in prison for violating the act. The act was a direct response to the Westboro Baptist Church and passed Congress 408-3, Ron Paul being one of the three, because fucking of course he was. Though challenged by the ACLU, the act was signed by George W. Bush in May of 2006. Of course, this didn't stop the church, obviously, but it limited their ability to garner attention by protesting dead soldiers' memorial services. Groups of American Legion members also formed motorcycle honor guards to protect funerals from protesters. There used to be some really great footage on YouTube of those motorcycle clubs protecting funerals from the Westboro Baptist Church. Sometimes protection looks like assault. What are you going to do? In 2007, Fred and his family were the subject of The Most Hated Family in America, a BBC presentation by Louis Theroux. The documentary highlighted Fred's daughter, Shirley, as a leader within the church. Fred and Shirley, in the documentary, expound on their belief that homosexuality should be classified as a capital crime and that Fred was a prophet sent to tell the world that social acceptance of homosexuality is a sign of the apocalypse. The documentary follows the Phelps family to a protest at the funeral of Kevin Ziegler, a 31-year-old soldier who died dismantling a bomb in Iraq, as well as a protest at a local synagogue, which highlighted Fred's anti-Semitism, something often ignored in coverage of Westboro activities. Shirley, though, was sort of the breakout star of the documentary, though. Shirley Phelps Roper was born, ironically, on Halloween in 1957, meaning that she was born into the Westboro Church. In the early 90s, she made appearances on multiple TV talk shows with her father and organized protests at funerals of AIDS victims. She appeared on Hannity and Combs in 2006 to defend her praise of the deaths of five Amish girls, and Sean Hannity called her an evil woman. Time's a funny thing, really. Now, most of Westboro's talking points are just right-wing conservatism and can be heard on Fox News. After the election of Barack Obama, Shirley led the church in protests suggesting that Obama was a Muslim terrorist, and also showed massive support for the birther conspiracy. Having been born into Fred's Westboro congregation, Shirley was clearly conditioned by her father from birth. Allegations that Fred was violent with his wife and children first surfaced in the 1970s when his son Nate left the church. Nate alleges that Fred would beat the family mercilessly and force the children to work to earn money for the church. This is what made me start comparing Shirley Phelps to Squeaky Frome, one of the Manson girls, and also a product of violent psychological conditioning by a pseudo-religious madman. A lawyer like her dad, Shirley maintained the church website GodHatesFags.com. She and her father were both formally banned from entering the UK and added to the Names of Shame list. Everything's cuter in the UK, and later banned from Canada as well. Fred preached his final sermon in September of 2013. For reasons that have never been specifically made public but have been kind of hinted at, Fred was excommunicated shortly before this and was removed from the Westboro compound entirely shortly thereafter. He then stopped eating and drinking entirely, according to several of his children. Members of the family have alleged that Fred's views softened in the last year that he was alive. Others attribute this to dementia and called Fred's late career behavior rank blasphemy. Fred Phelps died in March of 2014, and Shirley herself forbade them from having a funeral for Fred, saying that God abhors worship of the dead. Shirley was then stripped of her authority within the church a little bit after that and replaced by an all-male panel of elders. The church still operates, albeit in a limited capacity, nowhere near the $250,000 a year budget they were spending at the height of their, let's say, popularity. With an unclear number of congregants, but we know for a fact less than 70, and a diminished shock value, Westboro now just kind of fits into the larger American conservative movement. On some level, Westboro was a sign of where the right wing was going, and it's almost at this point hard to believe that there was a time that this group united everybody in hatred of this group. Their vitriol at the queer community is a clear precursor to things like Don't Say Gay, the violent reaction to Drag Story Hour, and the rampant transphobia that used to get you a spot on things like Ricky Lake. Fred Phelps fancied himself sort of the emissary of God's wrath in a pitched spiritual battle with a predetermined outcome that God hates the sinner, but that God chooses who sins and who doesn't. And sure, the Bible is full of evidence of God's wrath, God's jealousy, God's hate, just as much as there is for love, forgiveness, and charity. Fred chose to spend his entire life justifying irrational behavior as the will of God, and by all appearances, so poisoned the minds of his own family that when he showed signs of acceptance, they cast him out, just like he'd done to his own father when he started his weird crusade against, well, everything. And if there has to be a silver lining to any of this, it's the sheer number of people from Fred's family who have over the years left the church, and in many cases become fairly vocal activists for queer rights. His son Nate, his daughter Shirley's daughter Megan, there's I think 5 of Shirley's 11 kids alone have left the church, and I believe one of them is actually non-binary. But the thing that you that is sort of, I guess, a positive takeaway is that even though this cat spent generations conditioning his family towards homophobia and virulent hatred of everyone who wasn't a member of their family, the further out the generations get, the less they seem interested. And honestly, the more of them seem to be queer. So that probably says something about human social evolution and the possibility that sometimes the trash does actually take itself out. So there you have that. And there you have the Westboro Baptist Church and Fred Phelps. Holy fucking shit. Welcome back after a month off. We're just going to cram you full of slurs and stories about one of America's worst people ever for an hour and 20 minutes. Why not? You missed this, right? Well, if you did, and you've decided that you enjoy this unique brand of bummer core that I dish out, you can become a member of the illustrious and ever-growing Hep Cult by going to www.patreon.com/comeandseepod, and you will automatically receive a download link to the Uncle Bill mixtape, something that I put together in between seasons. That's about 10, I think it's 10, it might actually be 11, mixes similar to the ones that opened the show. Previous episodes have actually used a few of those songs, so that's an automatic benefit to you. Also, the 100th episode of the show is coming up here, I think in 4 or 5 episodes, so if you have any questions you'd like to have answered on the air, or you have any local activist groups that you'd like to have highlighted on the show, because that is something that I think I'm leaning towards doing for the 100th episode, and you are subscribed to the Patreon, you can shoot that on over, and it'll come out of my mouth on the airwaves. Like fucking magic, eh? I think that's all of the businessy related things there. No, it's not. No, it's not. I am rusty. Give me a second. If you would like to wear your support for the Come and See podcast, you can do so by going to comeandseemerch.bigcartel.com, where you can pick up one of our Come and See t-shirts, the second round of pre-orders of which are just about ready to ship now. I just need to get those back in from printer, and they'll be ready to go. We'll also be, I guess I'll give you a heads up. We're going to start running some ads on the show. Not for things like Ford and PlayStation and Coca-Cola and things that would make me a massive fucking hypocrite, but I'm going to be doing some ad reads on the show because, well, I do need to pay like my bills and things of that nature, and well, I need to find a way to make money out of this somehow. So, starting in July, you're gonna be hearing ads on the show. I kind of apologize in advance. I don't feel great about it, but it's a thing that's going to be happening. So there's a heads up for you. And on the plus side, you can rest assured knowing that like I have enough money to feed myself once the ads start running. So that'll be good. I think that's all the housekeeping, right? Is it? I believe so. Yeah, we'll call that good. Fuck it. until next time, I don't even remember how to do my own closeout. It's been a month and I don't remember how my own show ends. Let's take that back there. Fuck, I literally don't remember how the show ends. This is ridiculous. We'll be back. There it is. I got it back. We almost fell off the tightrope, but we got it, listeners. Okay, we'll be back. Same mucks. How much did you miss this level of professionalism? I mean, be completely honest with me. Same mucks time, same mucks channel. On the next episode of the show, we're going to talk about conversion therapy. I believe that ties in rather nicely to a previous episode we covered this season on brainwashing, conditioning, and cults, because I believe that conversion therapy probably comes out of the very same tradition as cult deprogramming, and we're going to get heavy down on that on the next episode of the show. So you'll have that to look forward to. But until then, concentrate on the HEP, everybody. Fucking nailed it! I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See, and I will catch all of you beautiful people. I changed it to HEP Cats this season, but you know what? It's fine. Ignore it. All of you HEP Cats, and all of you beautiful people, whatever you choose to identify yourself as, I will see you on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it, daddy-o.
God duped you and starting a war so he could punish you. Almost 18 months now, and the siege has got people eating their babies. You're gonna eat your babies, you jackass.
I'm finished.